Ash will too.
So the contents in the house, everything was there, and we found the fruit in the cellar, and my mother right away started selling the fruit. There were very few people returned to the town, and it was quite empty. And we started life normal again. There was no school for Jewish children. I had to wait the order came, and I could not go to school, and neither did any of the Jewish people. The Christian children could go to school, but we could not. Our school was closed. So, as time went on, weeks later, Germans were rounding up Jews and for work and taking them to the army barracks or all different work. They didn't pay them anything, but they're rounding them up ever so often. And they formed, the Germans told the Jewish community, well, we were there to form a Jewish committee. And then they decided to, if they needed any of the Jewish workers, they would go directly to the Jewish committee. And it went on that way. And every so often they used to round up people in the street, took them to work. And on several occasions I was caught myself. And on one of these occasions, we had to dig soldiers from graves and put them into boxes because there was a big battle around Sheraz, and we had to put certain bodies into these coffins. Was a horrible sight for me, and I was very nervous. We're guarded by the Germans.
So was this forced unpaid labor?
Yes, forced unpaid labor. And then later on, as time went by, I was caught on several occasions, and I was made to unload trains of briquettes, that's compressed coal, what the Germans made, dust, compressed dust. Me and another fellow, and the spade was larger than me, was very hard work, and I had to do this job. I didn't get any pay for it. As time went on, there was a shortage of cigarettes, and one day I had an idea to collect dimps in the street and cut the burnt part off and mix it with some leaves, and I started making cigarettes. I used to buy some filters with a special pusher. I used to start making filters because there was very little work for my father at that particular time, and obviously the family needed food and everything. I had an idea, and I was selling these cigarettes on the corner of Zamkova Street, and I was selling these cigarettes to the peasants, which were very happy to have them because you couldn't get any cigarettes. And I started doing very good business, and then I started running out of the filters, and I had to go on foot the 14 kilometers to Zrinjska Wola to try and buy it there, which I walked many times. I used to catch a lift on a horse cart, and when the peasant see me or notice me, he took the whip and he hit me very badly in the back, and I jumped off the cart and I marched on. It didn't deter me that. I was very determined. And as time went on, I was going to Zrinjska Wola buying these filters, and my cigarette business was doing very well. And I still walk towards the army garrison barracks, and I used to pick up a lot of things there, little boxes. And with the money, my parents could buy food or other different things. And then slowly we were put in the ghetto in the Jewish district. And it wasn't a fenced ghetto, but we weren't allowed to go out except for work. And when we did go out, we weren't allowed to walk on the pavement, only in the middle of the road. And the Yellow Star came in by law. Every Jew had to carry, wear a Yellow Star. And on the in the center was Jude. It says Jew, German. With me being small, I could get away with it. I wore it sometimes, and I didn't wear it when I got out. I walked on the pavement. Some Poles did know me, but I tried to avoid as much as possible. But I got away with it.
Were the synagogues able to carry on?
No. Forbidden to pray for Jews. So there were secret prayers kept in certain rooms, hidden. Because if we were caught and had anybody, they could have shot you for this. The synagogue were closed right away. As time went on, the Jews, there were a lot of different laws against the Jews, and they started taking young men from the town, Jewish ghetto, for work. The Germans ordered the committee to bring them 100 or 200 able-bodied men, and they were sent away for work. People didn't know where, but we've heard they went near Poznan, Western Poland. And as time went on, there was very few young people left or able-bodied men for work. And one night we were asleep, I knocked on our door. A German policeman came and he told my father to get up, and he's going to be taken for work. They didn't tell you where to get anything he can get hold of, and he marched him off. And that was the middle of the night, very dark. We're terrified, my mother and brothers and sister. And as my father was taken away in the middle of the night, he escaped. And the German police came back, knocked on again on the door, and then they took my brother, who was 4 years older than me. After about half an hour, the German policeman came back and he shouted at my mother, and he said, "Your husband and son escaped. Now I came back for your other son." That was me. I wasn't perturbed at all at that particular time, because I knew I was too small to go to Germany, so I had no worries about them taking me.
How old were you?
oh, it must have been about 12 at that time, or 11 and a half, or something like that. And I was not ordered at all. I went, and they took me to the police station, GMA police station, and then they gathered a certain amount of people. In the morning, they marched us off towards the Carrison barracks, and we went through a gym and looked at us if we were fit for work. And one of the elders of the Jewish committee was there, and my turn came, and the German said, "No, you're too young, you go back home." And the man from the committee, the Jewish man from the committee, says, "Well, his father escaped and his brother escaped. He should go." And my fate was so. They took me. And in towards that evening, they marched us towards the railway station. And we stopped outside the railway station for about an hour. There was about 120 of us. And suddenly I heard a hissing noise from the side of the station. And my brother was there with a suitcase. He says, "You go home." And I go inside and I says, "No, I've got more chances than you. If anything goes wrong, because I'm small, they won't do nothing to me." So I thought. And he begged me and he cried and he said, "I will go, I'm fitter than you, I'm bigger than you." But I said, "No, I will go." And we eventually went, we got on top, onto the railway wagons. There were still private wagons with windows and everything. That they came from. In the front there were Germans, and we were in the back, two wagons. And it took about 2 days, remember, overnight. And the following day, we eventually arrived at the station. I could see on that station the name called Potocno. Was a small station, and in the background I could see some barracks, wooden barracks. We told to embark, disembark, and there was a ramp on that station, and we told to stand there, put us all our suitcases on the floor, which we did, and after a short time, an elderly man with glasses came forward and he said, he looked on our group and he said, "Who wants to go back home?" So I went forward and I said, "I do." And some other people, and elderly people, we went forward, and there's about 25 of us. And we were told to stop, and then the rest were told to march towards the camp. There were black uniformed SS men, ethnic Poles. Each had a whip in his hand, not knowing what's awaiting us. The group marched on, and as they marched on, they had the Germans put down about a foot wide plank, and the soil was very clay, and they started driving on the people onto that plank, and as they were pushing and they were falling off, and the beating was just unbelievable. People were screaming and shouting, and the guys with whips were beating people, and eventually it came our turn. By the time they finished with us, were black and blue. I couldn't sleep all night with the pain. from the beating. They separated us into another barrack from the working people, because we were supposed to go home. After several days, a German, in that particular time, civilian, he walked on the square and he told all the people to come out from our barrack. I went out and he said, "Who wants to stop here in this camp and you work here and who doesn't want to go home?" None of us volunteered, because what we've seen from our welcome or greeting, we decided this is a devil's place, it's horrible. So we thought we're going to go home. Anyway, nobody came out, and we were told to go back to this barrack. And after about 2 days later, the same man came back, and we stood in front of him, and he picked me and about another 7 boys. I was the youngest. And he says, "You're going to work in the kitchen here, and you'll be bringing water into the camp." There was no pump water in the camp. And I thought to myself, well, there's no option. We've got to do it, what he says. We were selected and we were taken to a special place and put, strapped into a metal barrel with 4 wheels, and 6 of us pulled it like horses, and we had to walk into about 4 miles from this, 4 kilometers from this camp, and count the water for the camp several times a day, strapped them into this water container, and every so often, if you couldn't pull hard enough, the assessment, the black uniform assessment, lashed out at you with a whip. Quite often, and we all got a good hiding on each journey. And as people started coming back from work in the evening, they used to bring out certain people, and they used to put them on a board, strapped up, and beat them for no specific reason. We all had to stand around and watch what was going on. The work involved there was laying railway lines for the invasion of Russia to the east.
Was it summer or winter?
That was, it was the end, I think, of the end of going towards the end of winter.
So it would probably be 1941, because Russia was invaded in June 1941.
Yes, and that was still 1940 when we were brought there. There were, and the people who came home from work, beaten, starved, some of them started throwing themselves under the trains because they couldn't take it anymore. And you could see people started swelling up from hunger. They gave us very little to eat. And parcels that came from the families were distributed to the Germans, or very little got through. You couldn't write home. You weren't allowed to write home. It was hell on earth. People started to be hanged. There was a man or a boy of 21 from our town. I knew him very well. I used to be a very good friend of his of his brother, his younger brother. His name was Shimek Hildesheim. He went to beg for a potato at work, and the Germans said he tried to escape just near his work. And they brought him back, put him in a separate barrack. And one afternoon while I was there, they took him to the wash house, which was a barrack and metal, well, a long sink made of metal and extra toilets. They came with a rope and they hanged him, tried to hang him. The rope broke twice and we had to watch it and help with it, and I'll never forget as long as I live this situation.
This was done by Germans?
The camp commander, and the prisoners had to do it. There was one German which put the rope around him, and the rope broke twice, and the third time they succeeded, and we had to take his body and to bury it near where we used to collect the water in the village. And I buried many people there with some of my friends. And we had to take the bodies away into this village. No mark, grave, nothing. Hanging was very prevalent, beating. In 1942, one day I was taken by the camp commander and told to clean his office, and also the assessment to polish the boots and so on. On one afternoon, I came to clean his office, and he looked at me. He must have been about 75 at that time. He looked at me and says, "Do you want to go home?" And I was terrified, because all these people which wanted to go home who stayed with me in that barrack, who were not chosen for work, one day a metal lorry arrived, and these people were told to undress, and the back of the lorry was opened up, and they were driven in. Some of the assessment came with that skull, the skull and head on their caps, so I knew that's not a good omen. And they were beaten onto these lorries, and they were driven away, and on the way they gassed them with the exhaust in the car. And that's when they started gassing people. That was the beginning. We didn't know what's happened, but obviously that was the situation. And eventually when I went to clean the camp commander's office, this day he asked me, "Do I want to go home?" And I was terrified. And suddenly a man who was a painter before the one out of town, he was ethnic German, and I knew him from before the war. And the commander says to me, "This man came from Sheraz, and he's taking another person back. Do you want to go home?" And I said, "Yes, sir." He says, "Go and fetch your belonging," which was something in my hand. I ran back to the office, and we marched off with that man. Another boy from Sheraz, who was older than me by about 6 years, his name was Kuba Bloom, and we were marched over the station, and we were taken back to our town. On arrival, I couldn't believe it. the ghetto was still on. At that time, there were about 1,200 Jews left in Sheretz, in the ghetto. On arrival, parents, wives came to ask me what's happened, are they all right there? And I said yes. I was afraid. I had sense enough to say, didn't want to say what's happening there, because a lot of the men were already killed at that time. And I said, they're working hard, and that's all. From that camp, out of 2,500 men, 11 survived, and I am one of them. So is Maya Hirsch, and so is David Yusefovich. We were three young boys, a bit older than me, and they were all killed. Just 11 of us survived.
Why do you think that commandant made that gesture towards you?
I had no idea. I should clean his office, polish his shoes and so on. After the other work, after I did the water coming and so on, maybe because I was the smallest one in the camp, and he realized there's not much use for me. Not so many people were there left. And eventually the survivors were taken to the different camps. I was in Sheretz for 2 weeks. Every day we had to be counted on the square. Every day we had to be counted, all the Jews of the ghetto, which was approximately 1,200 people. And then we went back to our homes. Everybody had to work. I was working for a German policeman cleaning his house, fetching coal and all different things like that, menial jobs. And then one morning, about 5 o'clock in the morning, we had a Polish friend who used to bring food to us many times. We paid him secretly. He used to come into the ghetto and he woke us up and told us that the ghetto is going to be liquidated this morning. And if we want, he will hide us. But my mother decided whatever happens to everybody else will happen to us. At that time, my father was taken to another camp. But my brother was at home, and my sister was at home, and my mother. And my mother said, well, we'll take our fate, whatever happens to the other people.
Is this summer or winter?
That was summertime.
So
and about August of 1942. We were very nervous, but he tried everything possible to try and persuade my mother to come with him and hide, but you couldn't hide very much. Unfortunately,